gotten away. I was wondering more about whether there were pressures that your local AID folks got from Washington, which made them push your IDS folks out in the field to develop things faster than you knew you had to, or, you know, for the sake of, what you might say, pins on the map. Right. Say, well, we got these 100 projects, when in fact they were being pushed too fast to be really successful in the way that you're talking about. Was that a
problem? I'm not so sure it happened. I'm really
okay.
There were enough other things that were going on that using the regular aid technicians that would make that pin-putting process adequate, I think.
Okay.
But the IVSers, you see, were kind of an appealing thing because the visiting fire people, firemen, why, they could send them out to see an IVS guy. Wow, you were out there all by yourself out here? Yeah.
And he was.
Good PR, yeah.
Sure.
For the program.
Yeah.
And then I think there's another aspect. You're suggesting that the progress base is based on the number of cabbages grown or schools built. That also may be based on the human associations that come about that can't be written up or recorded or pinned up and so on and so forth. But the presence and the association can be perhaps consequential, at least in terms of developing a point of view towards a particular point of view. In other words, if these are young Americans, by example, if these, I'm a Laotian, I said, look at these young Americans, why are they here? What do they believe in? And maybe I should think, this is hypothetical, and maybe I should try to find out what they are. Oh, democracy, or republic. Oh, wow. At that point, now I become in favor of this kind of thing because new concepts have been introduced to me other than cement and roofing sheets. It's my association with this guy, or he comes to my place and eats and things like that there. So, and that's something that's intangible, and the only way I can say, unfortunately, for Southeast Asia is you can judge it on the basis of the people that immigrated or fled from those countries and have moved on, hopefully. Some of them, as you know, are still in refugee camps. But,
right.
But those that have come on, of course, that's something else again. And there are people who, if there had been peace, would have stayed in place and made a major contribution, of course. So that's a difference, right? That's a thing that we don't know about, right? Like Petsong, for instance. She would have stayed in Laos. She might have been working for some ambassador or somebody from the UN. She good in English and French and Laotian, of course. She had shorthand and typing, and so there you go. She was ready for, you know, a good future.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, anyway, having said that, now a little bit I want to mention about this. I did mention this selection business of people.
Yeah, very strict.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, we did some things that the Peace Corps I don't think ever did, and most management would have never done. For example, there are two guys I know that we brought out there at the age of 20. They had finished their sophomore year. And I think it was their sophomore year, maybe even freshman year. And they admitted that they didn't know what they wanted to do next. And so they were looking for something of value that they could do, whether they could get their sights aligned, and then they can move on. And that's okay. And yet, when it comes to orthodox selection of people, why, you know, that's ridiculous. What the heck, he doesn't even have a degree. And he's only 20 years old. He doesn't even know how to shave, for crying out loud, or something. Well, we brought out in a number of them. And fortunately, at one time in AID, well, we had two contract reps. Both of them who had been involved in social work in the United States as career assistants.
Okay, well, who were they?
Well, one guy was Sam Haight. And Randy right now, I can't think of his last name right now because I can't think of it.
Okay.
And, but they understood this concept of human development. And so two of these guys that I can remember right now, they came out, put in a couple years, went back home, got the degrees, and then went to work for AID again and had a career, and a successful career.
Uh-huh.
There you go. You see. Now, and this was much more true, I would say, after World War II, up until maybe in the mid-60s, than it has been since, where you have to have the credentials, whatever
that mm-hmm,
means.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be ridiculous. Like, for instance, with me, when I was with Heifer Project, the first, I went with a plane load of cattle to Afghanistan, and then when we unloaded them for an AID project there, I went down to Karachi to, there was a Heifer Project interest in Karachi. I went up to, Iran, Tehran, for there's an Heifer Project interest there. I went over to Jordan, went over to Egypt, and went up to Greece, and I was over to Lebanon, as I remember, and then eventually to someplace in Europe. I forgot which one of the several possibilities it could have been. It could have been Geneva, it could have been somebody in Germany, because we had Heifer Project interest in both places.
Uh-huh.
And then I came home. I'd never been out of the country prior to that. But, you know, something about the confidence of ignorance and also conviction, you know. And so you just did it, that's all.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Just as simple as that. If you're supposed to do it, you do it. All right. So anyway, that's, I would say, is pretty much the way these fellows
uh-huh.
did. They came out, fit in, went on their way. But whether or not that freedom or optimism would exist in modern times, I don't know.
Well,
depends on
yeah.
the risks, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, it depends on what you throw out yeah. to folks.
I would presume that most of the IBSers would have similar to what you call a Peace Corps reaction, and that was is that I benefited more from my tour than the people did, perhaps, with whom I worked.
Uh-huh. Well, you were up at a higher level than the average.
No, I'm talking about it. Me personally.
Yeah, you personally.
No, with me personally, you see, when I finished my tour, when I had a 3-month contract with AID, Rural Development,
uh-huh.
and I got a, I applied for AID employment, and I wouldn't have even had to gone home, except I had a home leave option, and so I exercised, I mean, end of tour,
uh-huh.
came back, signed up, went back, and all that.
How
so
long?
Then I had a tour with AID after that.
That's beyond the 3 months.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So how long is that one?
Oh, about 23 years.
Oh, my.
No.
Oh, see, because you didn't
yeah.
have that back then.
Yeah,
I didn't know this, you know.
Yeah, sure. Well, no, that's a saving grace, of course, for me personally, because that 23 years is a retirement.
Mm-hmm.
It's now, the interesting thing was when I was with IVS, I was chief of party. Oh, I was on the diplomatic list.
Yeah.
And Dr. Nofsinger advised me that when I went to Hong Kong, which I did do now, I remember, en route, I got myself a tuxedo and a white coat and the black shoes and all that other kind of diplomatic stuff.
Yep.
And when I landed, well, then I began to get invitations.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go to these affairs where the important people were. And at that point, making $2,000 a year. All right. Then I went to work for AID, and as I remember, my opening salary at that time was $8,000.
Uh-huh.
But I went off, and so I doubled or tripled, quadrupled my income.
Uh-huh.
I went off the diplomatic list, and so I'm just an ordinary little old worker. I was an assistant program officer, for crying out loud.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So what do you want, the money or the fame?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that was a significant difference.
Oh, yeah.
And this is generally true, I would say, for all of these non-government organizations.
Uh-huh.
The big fish, whatever they are, swim together.
Uh-huh.
And if you're head of a little organization, you swim with the big guys.
Yeah.
You know, go to the kind of conferences. And,
uh-huh.
Well, in a way, that's the way it was with me. I was a, somewhat of a fish with IBS,
uh-huh.
and I knew John Knopfinger.
Uh-huh.
Call him up. Yeah, Bob. There you go. Just like that.
Yeah. When you came in 61, how many people were there?
One. Esther Campos.
Because IVS had quite a few people before that.
All right, now, they had two teams.
Uh-huh.
There was a team up in Xingguang. That's what I call a rural development team.
Okay.
And then they also had an education team, which was in Wenchang.
Okay.
And that was affiliated with the university there.
Dandong? School?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah. Bernie Wilder was uh-huh. ahead of it when I got there. Do you know that name, Wilder?
No.
Well, anyway, amongst other things, he went on to become a director in AID missions.
Okay.
Yeah. But their job was to teach and work in the... They were involved in the university there, and
uh-huh.
I can't remember whether they were only in teacher education or not right now.
All right.
But anyway, they were Wenchang-based, and they were out at Dundalk at the university.
So you weren't counting them?
No, no.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
Because you said chief of party, but that would be chief of...
Two chiefs.
But there were two chiefs of party.
He was chief of that one, and I was chief of rural development.
Oh, I see. Okay. So he would have had X
point,
number of people under
yeah,
him.
I think it was 8 to 10.
All right.
And they
small
were different
group.
Subject matter people.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's the way that worked.
But there were no other ag people when you arrived, even though there had been earlier.
You mean IVS?
Yes.
Right. None. That the Xingguang team was closed down because
mm-hmm.
of the incursion.
Because
of
the security.
And the Chinese. And
yeah.
The,
yeah.
Not that long.
I thought they would have simply relocated and started them up somewhere else.
Well, I frankly don't know the length of the terms.
Uh-huh.
That existed, then they may have run out.
Okay, and then just not replaced.
Just came on back, yeah, because there's no place to go until it's upstarted again.
Okay, all right. So really, there's the first initial time of IVS
in
Laos.
In Xingguang.
Yeah, and then a dying out, and then a restarting
for rural development
in 61 again,
yeah.
as you recruited people
right.
and brought them in under your wing and found new places for them. Okay, all right. Well, that would explain some of the numbers and the ups and downs and some of those.
Now, to contemplate some of the so-called successes. Now, for our rural development team, we had a man named Walter Coward who
yep,
went on
heard
to
the
become
name.
A member of the Cornell faculty.
Mm-hmm.
That's one. And... I'm talking about, you know, this, we had a number of them went to work for AID, like myself,
mm-hmm.
and that was that group, and I don't know if you want names on that, but that's irrelevant. I mean, that I'm just, you know, trying to remember.
Yeah.
Coward was probably the guy that achieved the highest professional pinnacle because of his Cornell faculty. Involvement there.
Uh-huh.
There was a guy named Harold Daimler who was on the education team
uh-huh.
who probably went to the highest level of all, with the exception of Bernie Wilder. I don't know who got the highest. Bernie was a mission director, but Harold Daimler got involved in the mission administration, the general services officer type guy. And he was the number one GSO type guy for a while in Egypt.
Uh-huh.
That was a big mission.
Uh-huh.
He's now retired. It's about 3 or 4 years ago. And so he could have been, dollar-wise, maybe highest on the hog, partly because he stayed on longer. You know,
oh, sure.
His promotions and stuff like that.
Right, yeah.
And that makes a difference. And right now, I don't think all I can do is fumble around and try to think of people, and I haven't thought.
Okay.
On that subject right now. But I did want to identify Coward and Daver and Bernie Wilder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
Well, certainly the names have come up in form after form in terms people who were associated through some sort of supervisory capacity for many of the IVSers. How would you make decisions about where to locate people in terms of jobs? Mm-hmm. You've got a program, basically, that you're starting it again. And you know that the one earlier program collapsed because of security reasons. How would you figure that out? It's like consulting a Ouija board, I would think.
Yeah, well, obviously, your first consideration is security.
Yeah.
That's one.
But then there's also job viability.
Well, then you move on then to what kind of skills a guy might have,
mm-hmm.
which might be useful for a certain area.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would be an element right there. Then I would say you can settle on those two, because people can grow in these jobs.
Uh-huh.
I think. The way we thought.
Uh-huh.
I mean, how far are you going to go on this thing? You know, judge the rainfall and all that kind of thing as to whether or not you're going to send them. Now that I think of it, some of our so-called more mature human beings went out and worked by themselves. Whereas, remember I talked about these 20-year-olds?
Right.
They would be part of a team somehow.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That might be...
Give them a little guidance.
Leader and two or three guys. Well,
And
now that I think of it, that's the way it worked out.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that it was conscious, but nevertheless it did.
Pretty much human.
Yeah.
Human. But how would you get, offers or requests for volunteers from people? How did you get the...
All right, number one is, remember, you're working with the U.S. government. We work closely with the U.S. government.
Right.
We were part of the total project.
Correct.
Therefore, you would learn where people were needed.
From AID?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because it's the total project.
All right.
And at that point, then, you would say, well, we've got a guy coming.
Who might help you out here.
Now, should we put him out there? And then they read through his bio data and say, yeah, let's send him out there.
Okay. All right.
But there were enough spots around the country that were secure as far as location.
Yeah.
Now, it's true you couldn't get in a car and drive down to see them or drive over to see them or things like that. That wasn't secure. You might get bumped off. We had one guy, I remember right now, not in my time, but he decided he was going to drive down to a place called Takek, which was maybe, I don't know, 50, 60, 70 miles, and lo and behold, he never made it.
So you'd have to fly if you did anything.
Yeah, and then you had to fly the proper routes. I was just thinking about Air America.
Yeah.
And I can remember two or three guys who decided that they were going to take a shortcut home rather than fly the so-called secure routes.
Uh-huh.
Never got home in time for the cocktail party.
Uh-huh.
And
better to be late than not at all.
Yeah, that's right. And that kind of thing did happen. So we're talking about security as a site, and that was important. You had a sense of responsibility for the guys.
Oh, yeah, you wouldn't want to put someone out where they could get killed.
Yeah. And,
but how this may be a little bit beyond your own responsibility, because you said you coordinated with AID for the placement. But how would AID decide which project? Were they...
Well, number one is they knew the provinces, right? The provinces, the different provinces in the country. And so right now we'll think of a province called Sayaburi. There was no American in Sayaburi. Remember, we're talking about influencing people. We're not just talking about growing cabbages. So you got to have a presence to influence. You have to have a human being who associates with the governor, who associates with the village chief, and stuff like that. And at that time, there was nobody who was a foreigner who did that. And so it's easy to say, well, look, there's nobody there at all. Let's put an IDS in there. It's as simple as that, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And it's easy to find projects to initiate, you know, as I described.
Yeah.
Also, there was, just for your awareness, the Filipinos had a group called Operation Brotherhood.
Oh, yeah.
And they came.
So
they had a hospital. Theirs was the major hospital in Vientiane. And they also had a couple other field-based units, too, in Laos. They weren't as spread around as IBS was, but they had two or three, you know, good, reasonable concentrations, especially as it relates to a hospital or a medical facility.
Right. Yeah, well, they started that way.
Yeah. So that's the way that was.
Well, I was wondering if the Lao government ever made specific requests or coordinated.
If they did, I didn't know it.
Mm-hmm.
They would have probably talked to the rural development people,
mm-hmm.
to their so-called counterpart.
Okay.
See, the Lao, the proper counterpart definition, I would say, would be the head of the Rural Development Division of AID and the head of the Rural Development Division of the Lao government.
Okay.
Those two guys.
Yeah.
Then they may have sat down, talked things over. Again, that's part of the development process.
Yeah, I didn't know if as IBS you were a part of that dynamic.
No, I don't remember anything like that at all.
Okay, all right. Because you would have been the next level
in a sense. What would have happened is then the rural development people would have said, well, have you got any people on the list, and so on and so forth.
And then they would talk to you after they've done all that other stuff.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's a dramatic buildup from one person up to 30 in just a short period of time.
Yeah, it is, man. And
I don't
think of anything useful to say right now. That's
the
reason for my silence.
No, I was thinking of a question myself, but I didn't want to interrupt you in case you were going to say anything. And I'm when Mark first, that is my partner in this, Mark Gilbert, when he first thought of the idea of looking at IBS, and when I started to work along with him, the name that would most often come up for Laos was Pop Yule.
Oh, yeah, and I didn't even talk about him.
He was
part of the Xing Quang team.
Okay, so he preceded you.
Yeah, and he was there while I was there, but by that, when I got there,
uh-huh.
it was a kind of a hazy business. He switched from IVS to a U.S. government affiliation.
Yeah, yeah.
And I really don't know who employed him. I mean,
uh-huh.
which one of the different groups, because, as you know, there were a number of them there.
Uh-huh.
And so it wouldn't have been hard for him to have a State Department or a USIA or a CIA or some contract group. He could have been on the list.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
There's a lot of fuzzy type stuff in those days.
Yeah.
In terms of your affiliation with what you did.
Yeah.
No, Buell was a guy who rang a lot of bells. He was a man who did well in his assignment. He learned the language evidently quite he learned an effective communication capability.
I'm noticing that you're saying he wasn't exactly a linguist, but he got his point across.
Yeah, I think that's right. And,
yeah.
And people, once again, now we're back to this human relationship and communication
mm-hmm.
and influence business, and he certainly was good at that.
Uh-huh,
and
uh-huh.
I evidently used to come back here in Washington from time to time and really shake the bush and testify. You know, people would make some kind of a congressman would say something that was contradictory to what Buell thought or believed,
uh-huh.
and then he'd come right back at him. And, you know, he can say, "I saw it.
Uh-huh.
I was there." You know, and that kind of makes his testimony consequential,
uh-huh.
rather than just hypothetical or assumptive. But anyway, no, that's right. And he wasn't a was kind of a guy that, I guess, moved people because of his belief in sincerity, conviction, principle. Now, once again, he's got his own set, but nevertheless, he had him. Came out of Indiana, as you may know. And there were, I think there was, well, there's a book written about him, there was a movie of some kind, and also there's a Saturday Evening Post story about him.
I knew about the Saturday Evening Post story, and I know the book is called Pop or Mr. Pop,
something
like
that.
But I didn't know anything about a movie.
Well, I can remember a movie that I saw about him. I can remember the burial service in, or the funeral service in northern Indiana where he came from.
Yeah, you went to that?
No, I can remember it in the movie.
Oh, I saw it, yeah.
And I can't remember whether or not he was buried in northern Indiana or not.
He was buried back at his home.
Well, that was even northern Indiana.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
No, that was another you talk about the business of conventional employment concepts, employment concepts of candidates. Here a guy was who was in his 50s, maybe even early 60s. Well, I knew another guy on that spot. But anyway, he was ready to do something else. And IBS sent him over, and he did well. The education team had a former farmer school teacher, I remember, who did the same thing, and he was a good employee. Good IBSer. And as you know, Peace Corps now moves into the aged business and sending people.
Yeah, they did even when I was a volunteer in the late 60s. We had some two elderly women in our group.
Yeah, well, Mrs. Grandma Carter, for example.
Well, that might have been just for politics, but
she did well.
Yeah, but she did well. Yeah, but no, ours were not politically related.
Yeah.
They were just people who wanted to go into it, and they did. In fact, I was just talking with a couple of people this weekend who were in the same group as I, and they were talking about when they're retiring and thought maybe they go back into the Peace Corps again, go into a different country.
I think that one of the things that might be said, and I don't know exactly what you're working on right now, but part of the justification for the idea that that existed for Dale Clark to come up with this proposal of having young Americans was due to the Quaker work camps, of course, which existed. And the Brethren and Mennonites also had some work camps scattered around. So these three denominations, now, I have a hunch that investigation will find that the Methodists and the Episcopalians may have had the same thing prior to World War II. And maybe immediately after, don't know. But certainly the Mennonites and Brethren and the Quaker all were in Europe soon after World War II. And these were young people that were working. And the point is, and this gets me back to this business of this, what I would call this selection of people without credentials, but who have got the necessary stuff to rise to the occasion. And that happened an awful lot after World War II, particularly on these assignments like you're talking about. And you might identify yourself in that same way as, you know, how you were when you went, how you were when you came back. And the people were willing to do it. And now, so anyway, that's just the way it was.
No, I think I understand what you mean, because that was certainly true with me in terms of being underqualified to be an agriculture extension agent, but I did it.
That's right.
You know.
Yeah, if you wrote your job description, you wouldn't be able, I mean, requirements, you wouldn't be able to.
No, I couldn't have done what I actually did, but as soon as they said, you're going to do this, I said, all right.
Show me a chicken, huh?
Well, chickens I would have had trouble with, but I did all right with rice and vegetables and rabbits. So, you know, that
was good enough. I think also, too, that after World War II, you had a lot of people who were affiliated with family farms and small industry or small business. And so that source of human beings. A little bit different than it is modern times.
Yeah, yeah. Family farm has pretty much all but disappeared.
That's
now.
Right. And, you know, one of the paradoxes is that when I was with Age, sometimes they would bring people to the United States and have them go up where the Amish were, where they used horses and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
Because there, to move from some underdeveloped countryside to Lancaster County was a major jump anyway.
Right, exactly.
And, but it was a jump, you know. And here the horses are, and here the harnesses, and there's the plow.
Yeah, one fellow that I know that this side is coming to an end real quick,
right.
So I'm going to just tell this story.
Yeah, right. Uh-huh.
Now there is a fellow, an IVSer, who was part of the Zing Guang Project, and his first name was Larry. And so I'm just going to stick with Larry right now because I can't remember that name.
Okay.
But anyway, on this particular Saturday up in Zing Guang, they were working on some kind of a project where they had a tractor and a steel cable that was attached to something. And this steel cable got encircled around his leg below the knee. And the tractor pulled away, and it essentially broke his leg or cut it off or something like that. And there he was. And this was Saturday afternoon. And he was up in Zing Guang. Remember, we're talking about these sideband radios. So anyway, they got him over there to, they got to the sideband radio in Zing Guang.
Uh-huh.
And they called down to Vientiane. And it seems that there was some guy on this Saturday afternoon decided he'd walk into the room where the radio was, because he just happened to be there and he heard this incoming call. Nobody was on duty.
Uh-huh. They were just trying to see if they could route somebody.
Well, they were calling down open, yeah.
Yeah.
And he was just walking around and he heard the incoming call and they got the message. And, of course, then they went up and got him.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, took appropriate action and stuff like that. And eventually he went on to be an aid employee, too, in his latter days. I mean, after he recovered and got his
Yeah,
disease.
Yeah, uh-huh, okay.
But that was one injury. Then there's another one that we had that had to do with a guy. He was going to be an accountant. And he had a record of some kind of mental uncertainty. I'm using that term right now intentionally because I can't be specific.
Uh-huh.
And so it came out. And what happened was is that I showed it to the one of these two men.
You showed the medical record.
Yeah, the whole shebang.
Yeah.
The application form and stuff. And remember, they were both social workers, the guys that I worked with. And, you know, they're inclined to be a little bit more tolerant. And once again, he was going to be the accountant there in Vientiane. He wasn't going to be a field guy.
Well, that's a little different, maybe.
Yeah, sure. Well, anyway, this is the theory.
Uh-huh.
And the point of view, anyway. And so we decided to prove him. Well, what happened was is that, you know, once again, if you get on the plane in New York and then you fly to San Francisco, and then you fly to Hawaii, and then you fly to Tokyo, and you have a couple nights in Tokyo, and you fly to Bangkok, or whatever it is, and by the time you get to Vientiane, it can be somewhat tiring.
Oh, yeah, you're flying 4 or 5 days and a couple days layover.
What else we'll talk about, the psychological impact of change and something like that. So anyway,
sure.
He showed up. And that night, the next morning, I just forgot when it was, I got a phone call from the Marines, and they said, you got a guy that said da-da-da-da. And I said, yeah, I guess. And he said, well, we just found him sitting in the mud, making mud pies. And the poor guy had broken down. You know, unfortunately. So here you had, once again, one of these tries to give a guy a chance. It didn't work out. Well, then, of course, we had to, he went over to the Operation Brotherhood Hospital, and he was there for about a week while we were working out arrangements. IVS had to supply a 24-hour on-duty attendant.
Sure.
Of course, I was one of them. And,
can't be sure what he would do to himself.
Well, he was just in a regular hospital room, you know.
Yeah.
And so eventually we put him on a plane and came on back. And I don't know any more about that. But nevertheless, there you have a kind of another kind of a impact of change.
Had a culture shock and such.
And
I'm glad to hear that story because I had talked to volunteers, you know, I've talked to other people before. And occasionally I would ask that, you know, did anyone had to get shipped home for any reason? And nobody seemed to know of it, but of course they weren't country directors, so they wouldn't have known necessarily about people, becoming somewhat unglued in that new position, because I knew that it happened in the Philippines, because I knew a couple of volunteers who had to be medically evacuated, and the medical was not physical. So I couldn't imagine that wouldn't also happen in Laos and Vietnam, where the culture would even be more foreign to the American experience than the Philippines, which was so relatively Americanized.
Yeah. And then, of course, you had this business of different kinds of diseases that happened to people.
Uh-huh.
I remember one guy we had to ship down to Bangkok, and I forgot what his condition was, but nevertheless, he went down there there was a hospital in Bangkok that was run by the Seventh-day Adventists.
Uh-huh.
So that was a good so-called
American-related
hospital. And he went down there for a period of time, then he came back and went on his way.
There's all sorts of parasites and worms that you pick up, but that's sort of
that's
the daily.
Yeah.
I'm going to open this up, I think, but most of the office would either be gone or... Let me see if anyone's around.
What time do they
just got to pause this. I don't know. Tell them here. It looks like you're making some notes.
No, I was just trying to... I just wrote down here, it's not a complete list, and I don't... The number of Lao people, Lao IVSers, that went on to work for the U.S. government.
Oh, really? Okay.
And right now I got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, I think.
Wow.
And there may be even more than that.
These are people, Lao, who worked with IVS folks?
These were IVS Americans.
IVS Americans. Who later worked for AID. All right. Jeez, yeah.
But anyway, now that suggests another thing, and that is the business.
Who's on the list there? Because some of them I might be folks that I'm interviewing later, you know.
But we're going to talk about the Laotians, who got a start. So we got Tetson, who eventually, she came, and now she's working here in the United States.
And you said somewhere in D.C.?
Yeah. And then there's another guy who has worked for a number of the intelligence groups. He's here in the United States, I remember.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another man who has worked in Lao and Thai language instruction at the Foreign Service Institute here in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people that I know of right now that I can think of. And it's
it's not unlikely that there weren't more of them. But remember the people that I'm talking about were ones who were in this what I would call the dropout crowd. They didn't make it academically in the baccalaureate.
Mm-hmm.
Now in the education team, that was a little bit different. They had had higher level colleagues, compatriots, or whatever it was. And then you're familiar with the, what the AID calls its participant training program, or foreign students is another easy way to example. Well, they had people going right up to the doctorate then.
Oh, really?
And that kind of thing. Uh-huh. But the people I identified were staffers. Like Petzold was a staffer.
Uh-huh.
And so...
got really hands-on training.
Yeah.
And built on that.
Yeah. The thing is that I don't think as many of the Laotians came to the United States as maybe the Vietnamese. Well, the numbers were entirely different for the gross total. No question about that.
You mean in terms of numbers of volunteers?
No, a number of these foreign people who had benefited from U.S. experience or association or training.
Were greater in Vietnam, of course,
yeah.
Okay.
Just because you had more people in it.
Right.
Yeah. And,
at least dollar amount, larger programs, and all that.
No, I was in Vietnam. I ran a school over there.
Okay.
At that one, at the fall of Vietnam, well, I think it was something like 6,000 Vietnamese people had been involved in what they called participant training, which meant that they went somewhere and came back.
Uh-huh.
And that was everything from what you might call a nuclear scientist to somebody that went over to Taiwan for 2 weeks to see a rural cooperative or something.
Uh-huh.
Like that. But that's quite a crowd of people, 6,000.
It's an impressive bus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
for any country.
Sure. And that was, and of course, we had a participant training program, too, in Laos, but most of them were involved in education, and that's why people like that were involved in the education project could speak to that more easily.
Right.
Now, there's Bernie Wilder. He's down here in Maryland. He's not too far away.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we didn't hear from him, evidently.
Well, was he really IVS?
Well, he was IVS. He was the chief of party of the IVS education.
Okay.
And then he switched to AID too.
Okay. Well, let's see what I had in terms of a list. Tapes back on. Bernie Wilder was listed down here as being out of country right now with AID.
What's the date on this thing?
This was given to me this past April.
Well, he might have a special short-term contract.
Yeah, so he may be out of the country now, and that's why we didn't hear anything back from him. He's been gone for a little while. I don't recognize the name of the place. N'Djamena, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where that is.
It's in Africa.
It's an African place, okay. So that's where he is, and we didn't send things out to people who were out of country simply because it would be too hard to communicate and all that sort of stuff. So, okay, so that takes care of him.
Yeah.
Well, might be. It might not be a bad idea just to try and look him up in a phone book or something like that.
Yeah.
I see that you added a couple of more names down there, and
that
list is growing as you just kind of think about things.
Yeah. I got a couple of blank spaces, but nevertheless, they represent people. You know.
Yeah, with an image but without a name. I do that a little frequently myself. Oh, gosh. You know, it's pretty rare that I've talked to anybody who is as high up in the administration of the program, of a program, mm-hmm. as yourself, because most of the people that I've spoken to did their normal 2 years, maybe a little bit more, and then went home or went later on and joined AID. Also, you're a little bit different because you went in the organization older than and more experienced than the average person that went on there.
Yeah, well, if I went in at 61, well, I was 41 years old.
Yeah. Whereas most of the people, how
61, yeah, 41.
Yeah, about 40, 20. 41, mm-hmm. 1920 there. What was the average age of most of the volunteers?
Oh,
now, you said there were some that were 20, but, you know.
I'd say, I don't know, I guess I'd come in around 23 and a half or 24.
23, 24.
For the average.
Okay.
Because we had a few 28ers.
Okay.
Like that, that guy who was a doctor and a
That's
PhD,
right.
He would have had to have some age on him, and then we
sure.
had a veterinarian who had some, and we had another guy who had some.
Was the veterinarian Taylor?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, he told me, I saw him, he's now still a veterinarian.
Did you see him in Ohio?
Yeah, in Ohio, Mount Gilead, Gilead, and he told me that he... If I don't know if he's on your list, but he later joined AID for a term after his Laos experience.
We'll put him down then. I didn't know he did.
Yeah. And he told me that he was up with Buell at that time.
Well, he was also out in another place all by himself.
Yeah.
I'll talk to you about. Now here is an example of a man who.
You mean Taylor?
Taylor, yeah.
Okay.
Who had freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say was never able to exercise all the things, do all the things he wanted to do, partly because of what he wanted to do, or unwillingness to use money for what he wanted to do. He was. As a veterinarian, you know, he wanted to get started really in medicine.
Right.
And that never worked out. And as an original field guy, and then he switched to Pop Buell, and
uh-huh.
at that point, that was major endeavor right then.
Uh-huh.
Of
uh-huh.
a different kind. It was a humanitarian activity rather than an agricultural one. But anyway.
But do you think he couldn't do what he wanted to because the money wasn't there? Or?
Oh, I think it was a combination of administration and money. Yeah. And I'm part of administration. Yeah.
Oh, you wouldn't let him do some of the things he wanted?
Yeah.
And okay.
also aid agriculture, wasn't enthusiastic about it either.
Oh, okay.
It's like you out there, all of a sudden you wanted to do a project that Caribou or something or other.
Yeah.
Never worked out.
Yeah, because my regional director or the tech specialist said, no,
yeah.
can't do that. Okay.
Did he mention a guy named Volkner? Harold Volkner at all?
Jeez, I've seen so many people, I don't know exactly what everybody mentioned, but I can't remember that he did.
Volkner, I don't know where he is. That's why I was curious.
Oh, well, I could at least try to look him up here for you.
But,
see
Volkner,
if they've got... Harold Volkner. Voelkner.
What did it say?
It's in Bethesda.
I don't believe it.
6335 Ridge Drive, Bethesda, Maryland.
Okay, when we get done, we'll look it up in the phone book and see if he's there.
Okay, all right.
But anyway.
I'll stick you in a piece of paper right there.
Yeah. But no, he was an interesting man because he came out of Europe in World War II. His parents were Germans, and this was during the war. And they actually walked from Eastern Germany into the Western side. And at that point, somewhere along the line, he affiliated with American forces and got himself a citizenship in that fashion. And so he had that as a background, and then he came to the United States. I think it was Cornell he went to, where he got his agronomy degree. And then at that point, he got involved in IVS. And then after IVS, he had some aid time, and then he had some FAO time.
Uh-huh.
And then he got private business back in Hong Kong. And southern China.
Pretty interesting life.
Yeah, he had a brother who was in the manufacturing business in Hong Kong. I think he made watches, his brother did. And somewhere along the line, Volkner met this, maybe he was in Cornell, met this Philippine who was studying at the same time when we married. And so they had... They had a couple of children, and then he was shuttling back and forth between here and Hong Kong and southern China. I don't know.
Southern China?
Yeah, he's been at this, and he really got out on a limb. That's the reason. He had a second mortgage, his house, that kind of stuff.
So it's a risky kind of business to be in.
Well, it was then.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, he was there... Well, I'm talking now about maybe 10 years ago, or 8 to 10 years ago, that he was still...
Yeah, even though Mao was already dead, it was still not a very auspicious moment to begin business like that.
So, but I would say most of our people were, in a sense, the way somewhat similar... age-wise, Peace Corps people.
Okay, well, I asked
that. Out of college for a year or two.
Well, okay, that's somewhat similar, but I think Peace Corps was a little bit younger. One of the things that impressed me was that there was this little bit of difference with IVS folks, that they might have had a little bit more experience than we did in Peace Corps. You know, I mean, not that they weren't young, not that they might not have been naive sometimes, but they were less young and less naive than Peace Corps people, or at least so it seemed to me. Did you lose anybody? You mentioned injuries and such. Did you have any deaths during your watch?
Not during mine, but the subsequent one did. You remember
afterwards.
I talked about that guy who was driving down to Taukek and
The fellow who followed you.
Yeah. And then there was a fellow I remember got killed in Vietnam, too.
There was.
And those two that I can remember.
Okay. Because by 61 through 63, most of the action, I think, in a military sense, still would have been confined pretty much in Vietnam and very peripherally in Laos.
Up in the north.
Yes, only in the north, and not
over in the Ho Chi Minh Trail area too.
But even that wasn't as developed as it would have been later on. So security is something you had to look at, but wouldn't have to obsess about as much during your time as perhaps later.
And I think that there was a guy that drowned.
Murphy?
Could have been.
Yeah, because I talked to one of the Lao volunteers later and saw his annual report book sort of thing. This guy, fellow named Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, forgot about it.
That's just an unfortunate event, which could happen anywhere in the world, but I was more concerned about security things as an indication of how that might affect volunteers in the field.
I don't know any guy that actually got wounded.
Mm-hmm. Even.
Either in Vietnam or, but of course, I don't know, Don, he may know more about that. Well, he should know more about that, but I don't know anything about violence or Vietnam.
Yeah.
I can tell you other stories that related to me and my AID time, but that's not necessarily
it wouldn't necessarily apply directly to what was going on. I was impressed, though, that you said you were in charge of a school in Vietnam. Did you ever work as an AID official with then IVS volunteers, you know, during your subsequent period when you were in AID? Did you have any IVS assigned to you?
No.
Okay. So there wouldn't have been another crossover in that. Okay.
Never did.
Well,
I was in Vietnam, in Saigon, there was a school.
Mm-hmm.
It was a adult education school. It was for Vietnamese employees of the U.S. government and the government of Vietnam.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And the subjects taught were English and typing and shorthand and accounting and management and data processing, telephone techniques, and all that kind of stuff.
All the things that they had to know for their jobs.
We had a faculty, they were all Vietnamese, but it was really a tough one because there was a Ford Foundation guy came out there once and took a look, and he claimed it was the best faculty in Southeast Asia, and I wouldn't dispute him because we had, as I remember, 3 PhDs in the language arts, whatever they were, you know, linguistics and teaching. We had 5 masters, and then we, in the same subject, teaching English as a foreign language. So now we got 8.
Right.
Then we move on to the rest of them who had degrees in history or education or agriculture or something like that. And when it came to the business department, we had, as I remember, 1 PhD, 1 master, and 1 MBS in our business faculty. Well, that's pretty good, you know. And
not bad at all, not shabby.
Especially when the, as I remember, our faculty on English was about 40 people, so 8 of them got advanced degrees. And I can remember they would put on these in-service training sessions, and I'd go and listen to them talking about the stuff. They were really, it was tough stuff, you know, at the doctoral level. So it was good from that point of view of staff training. And we had a language lab, and our success was quite good. And I will also admit that I didn't start it. There was a Canadian guy that did. And he did, and it's like a lot of good things. He started, and it continued on. Also, I was involved in orientation of new Americans and new Vietnamese to AID. And so we would have these sessions. And once a month, as I remember it, for the Americans, I can't remember how frequently we did it for the Vietnamese, but we're talking about new employees.
Yeah.
And that was always good for me because you look at people and you develop new friends and associations.
Sure.
That was good. And also, I personally, I had an interesting subject that I taught, and that was preparation for schools or education in the United States. And
pretty important.
And these people were, of course, middle-aged folks, and in the conventional Asiatic and French educational system, and all that.
It's a big switch.
And on the first day, this was a standard ploy of practice of mine. They'd all be in the classroom. It was a Saturday morning, and we did it for 8 sessions. And we had all kinds of things, like how to take exams. And, you know, for
first day I'd come in with an old pair of sloppy pants on and some tennis shoes with the strings flapping and the t-shirt that hung down. I'd come in and slop in and stand up on the table, on the raised platform
in
front of everybody. And of course they were astounded. Of course the Orientals may be astounded. They don't look like they're astounded, but they were.
Yeah, right.
And I tell them, here's your first rule. Is remember, you are here to learn and hear what I say and not how I look.
Uh-huh.
And then after I chew that up a little bit, two or three different ways, and I sit down and we go on to the session. And there, as you know, they, like a lot of people, placed importance on the appearance of the people
uh-huh.
as to what kind of quality or value they, their ideas are and opinions are.
Oh, sure. It happens here, too.
Sure.
I watch how I dress.
Yeah.
There's female faculty also
mm-hmm.
paying special attention not to appear too feminine.
Right.
Sure,
mm-hmm.
to the male to the male undergraduate, but this kind of brings me to at least what would be the last of my real questions, and it almost doesn't apply to you in a sense, but it might, because the IBS experience certainly changed a lot of people, or at least remolded them in some way. So, your thoughts on that?
Well, I would say this. The first thing is that it changed a lot of my attitudes towards Christianity.
Oh, how so?
Well, all of a sudden I realized that there are valid religions in the world other than Christianity.
Uh-huh, okay.
And there may be only one God, or there may be a lot of gods, but religion as such
uh-huh.
exists throughout the world because there's a need for religion, number one. And number two is religion provides to society certain values that make it possible for society to function. It gives values and behavioral direction and predictabilities and things like that there. So you got to have a religion. And so I accept that. But as far as being a so-called Orthodox Christian believer,
uh-huh.
well, that faded away and has, still has. Which may or may not be good for me personally, but it's really good. So that's one thing. Secondly, I think that I became aware of the fact that the professions don't necessarily determine the quality of person that you might be. Now, what's that quality of person?